Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hey everyone, this is Amuse News. Today we are coming at you in the afternoon. I'm your host, RJ. We are taking you on an adventure through the food world. And today I have a guest who's going to talk to us about Passover and Jewish cooking and other Jewish holiday foods. It's going to be a lot of fun. But first, I just want to share a few news items because it's been a couple days since we last talked. So we appreciate you guys tuning in, and for everyone, we appreciate all the feedback, and lots of people have been telling me that they enjoy what we're doing, and we're still learning as we go. But we have a bunch more awesome episodes coming over the next couple weeks, so stay tuned and share with your friends. Okay, so we're going to talk, as I mentioned, to Amanda Dell in a few minutes. I also saw an article in Food and Wine that I wanted to share about what makes food kosher, and it talks a lot about Passover, and they go into depth about what it means for food to be kosher, as well as some Passover dishes, which again, we're going to cover with Amanda, but I'll put the link in the show notes to that, that read from Food and Wine. Okay. I got two takes on decaf coffee today, two related, but different takes. One of them is that decaf coffee is taking off, and apparently the decaf coffee market will grow to a $28.8 billion industry by the end of the decade, which is wild to me and inconceivable in a lot of ways, because I just couldn't drink coffee without the caffeine in it. So I don't know. That's just me. But I wonder if people listening or watching are people who drink decaf coffee. But then I saw an article from Food and Wine that decaf coffee could potentially be unsafe for human consumption. And maybe people have known this for a while. I did not know this, but this article goes into a little bit depth about how decaffeinated coffee beans go through this process, which use chemicals that are linked to health risks, which can be worrisome for these people who are apparently 26 million Americans who drink decaf coffee every day. So methylene chloride, I think, is the likely carcinogen that's often used in the decaffeination process. So, you know, there's one perspective that's saying that we're going to, you know, everyone's going to be drinking decaf coffee, and others said it's unsafe. I don't know. I drink coffee with caffeine in it because I like to be caffeinated, but I wanted to share that with you all. Curious what you all think. Send us thoughts in the comments and all that. Okay. There was another article from our friends at the Food and Environment Reporting Network. It was a review of Teresa McCullough's new book, Insatiable City, Food and Race in New Orleans. This book takes a dive into the history of food culture in New Orleans and the ties, the generational, racial, and political ties that made the city's distinct cuisine one of the most acclaimed in the world. One of my favorite cities to go to. And I'm sure for all of you who love food, you love it as well. Food and music. What an amazing, amazing city. But this book review and the book, I think, goes into a lot of depth on this idea that New Orleans is kind of a laid back city, and, you know, maybe sometimes is not going into depth on some of the more, some of the more sad, the evil side of what made New Orleans what it is today. There's a lot of talk about, of course, about slavery and about how slavery was used for a lot of the things that New Orleans became famous for, a lot of the crops and a lot of the food that came out of there. And also, as New Orleans began to export its culture, including jazz and Creole cuisine, many Black Americans who were part of that were left behind. So a really interesting read about this book, and I'm hoping to check out the book as well. So I wanted to mention that. One thing, you should check your fridge. If you drink this stuff called caffeine-free or sugar-free Schweppes ginger ale. You should check these this recall, because apparently Pepsi recalled this zero sugar drink because it's actually full of sugar. They're recalling more than 230 cases of sugar and caffeine-free Schweppes ginger ale, as the product was inadvertently made with full sugar, making it unsafe for people to drink who can't have sugar. So check your fridge if you're drinking this. Okay, this is our last week of our anniversary tour. So I want to tell you about a couple of things. I talked last week about the special package that we're putting together with Maggie Rose for Nashville. This is two tickets to the Brooklyn Bowl Maggie Rose show on May 10th and a meet and greet VIP experience at Brooklyn Bowl, as well as two nights in a hotel and dinner at Blue Aster in Nashville. This is an amazing package. There will be bids available. You can bid on this through Monday. So we have 5 days left of bidding. And then the last city I wanted to tell you about today, LA, we have an amazing restaurant, Jelena, who has donated a meal for two. And we have two tickets to the Wiltern in LA. And there is a bonus for LA. So the idea again is that if you go to the link in the show notes, or you go to heritageradionetwork.org/15, you can donate and support what we're doing here and be entered to win dinner for two and tickets for two to a concert in the city of your choice. So in LA, there is a bonus, which is a overnight stay at a place called Vitoria, which is part of the Jelena kind of group compound. It's one block from the boardwalk and the beach in Venice. So if you bid on LA, you could win two tickets to the Wiltern, dinner at Jelena, and an overnight stay in a hotel, which is pretty awesome. So we appreciate all of the people who have donated and all of the great venues and restaurants who have participated. Okay, so now I'm going to bring on my guest, Amanda, and I'll have her introduce herself. And we're going to talk a little bit about Passover and this new book. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, RJ. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, can you just tell us, give us a quick introduction about you and the organization?
Certainly. Yes. So as RJ mentioned, my name is Amanda Dell. I'm a native New Yorker and I former Heritage Radio Network podcast host. So excited to be back with the family. I'm the program director of Jewish Food Society. We're a nonprofit organization and we work to preserve, celebrate, and revitalize Jewish culinary heritage from all around the world. And we are building the largest archive of family recipes and histories, which you can find at jewishfoodsociety.org. And we preserve families' recipes and we share the histories that are attached to them as well. And we do all of our own research, create all of our own photography, and we take this work really seriously to present what we hope is a really vibrant and diverse archive.
That's really cool. And I got a chance to look at this book, The Jewish Holiday Table, which is behind you.
Yes.
Really beautiful photography and really cool recipes. And I want to talk a little bit about that. At the beginning of the book, it says the meal is the holiday, which I thought was an interesting way to start. What does that idea mean to you and to the book?
Yeah, well, I think it's everything. I mean, after we had been doing this work, you know, to create this, our archive, you know, we got the fortunate opportunity to be able to make this book, which was a dream of ours for so long. And so many people, you know, contributed to getting this book made, which I'm sure we can, you know, talk about. And the meal is a holiday is really kind of the idea that we center the book around. So it's based on the calendar year and all the calendar year, the agricultural calendar, and basically all the holidays that Jewish people celebrate. So for each holiday, we present 4 to 5 different families and what their menu would be for the holiday and what they serve. So I think that, you know, the meal is just so integral to who we are as Jews and our holidays and many of the holidays that we celebrate. Food is really at the center of storytelling, none more than Passover really. But I think, you know, I think that in 2024, there's so many different types of Jews and everyone has their own relationship with Judaism and religion. But I think for many Jews, holiday meals and those foods are how they connect with their Judaism and how they're finding themselves within Judaism. So I think for a lot of people and holidays, they might not necessarily go to shul or they might not have the same, you know, experience ritually as they did growing up or their grandparents did, but gathering around the table and sharing a meal on this holiday, it for a lot of people is the holiday.
It's interesting, like as a Christian, you know, like Christmas, yeah, or some of the holidays we celebrate, they're like, there's a meal, you know, but it's not, yeah, it's not necessarily the main focus. It's a part of it. And based on what I know, like Passover specifically, it is at the center, right?
100%. And I can definitely, love to share more about that. But yeah, so many of our holidays are really based on the food, you know. The foods that we serve are all part of the storytelling of that holiday and are very represent, you know, for Hanukkah, for example, we know we have fried foods and that's to kind of remind us of the oil that burned in the miracle of the oil burning in the temple for 8 days when it was only supposed to burn for one. So many, many holidays are, and the foods that we eat are centered around retelling these stories and the significance that these foods hold. And that's how we mark these holidays.
That's amazing. And thank you for explaining that. One of the things that I noticed quickly going through the book is the kind of the role of women in the Jewish kitchen, and just curious about like that aspect of it and also how you kind of found these people to profile and to gather recipes from.
Sure. Love to talk about that. If we want to go back to Passover, just let me know. We'll circle back to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll come back to it. Yeah.
But, yeah, we dedicated the book to the, you know, women and women in our lives and women, you know, in greater Jewish history and also in the kitchen. Of course, we have many men in the book, you know, fathers, grandfathers, and I think those also hold a special place in our heart and are, of course, like important, you know, from their culinary contributions. But we felt with our, you know, research that a lot of the recipes that are getting passed down are done so from the matriarchal side. And it's been really like beautiful also to see how we've captured a lot of the recipes and the histories from these mothers, grandmothers, but also how now the younger generation is also taking inspiration from that and, you know, making them their own in some cases while still honoring these beautiful traditions that have been, you know, part of their family for a long time. We had to give a shout out to the women.
Yeah.
Felt that was, you know, important and really also just marking this special time that we've spent with a lot of them in the kitchen and also their dedication to these recipes and stories.
So, okay, well, let's go. Thank you for sharing that. Let's just go back to Passover just because it starts in a few days.
Yes.
and obviously I'm sure you've been thinking a lot about it, but can you just tell us more about the role, sure, that food plays in this holiday and,
sure,
and why it's so important?
Yeah. Well, Passover is the holiday where we remember the Jews' exodus from Egypt after being freed from slavery. And the centerpiece of the holiday is really a meal called the Seder, where we basically retell this entire story and use food in a variety of ways. Of course, there's the most famous Passover food, or the one that's really the most special or pertinent, which is matzah, because matzah is what we use, which is like an unleavened cracker. Basically, it's eaten because to commemorate the journey that the Jews were taking and how they didn't have time to wait for bread to rise, essentially. So all that they, when they were escaping, so all that they had was this unleavened cracker, essentially. So for observant Jews, they don't eat any leavened food for the entire duration of Passover. So basically, at the Seder, we retell the story of this Exodus through different foods, through a Seder plate that has different symbolic foods on it, and through, of course, eating matzah. So it's fun. It's a lot of drama.
and a long meal, right?
It's long. I think it depends, again, on your family and your community and your level of observance. And, you know, there are seders that go for hours and hours and hours, and that's some people's traditions. Others, you know, have a shorter version.
One of the things, just looking through the recipes in the book, one of the recipes I saw was like chanterelle stuffed matzo balls in broth, and sounds delicious and also like a little bit of a different take. And so how much leeway do people have? And were you specifically looking for kind of different takes on classic dishes?
That's such an interesting question, especially like for someone like myself who grew up in New York. And I think that before, you know, I was fortunate enough, you know, to have my role now, I myself had a narrowed view of what Jewish food was, had a more, you know, or is. And I think if anything that I've learned, you know, is just really to remind myself that Jews lived all over the world, and their food is, you know, what makes, we could get into talking about for hours, like what makes a food Jewish. But really, like, I don't think there's one definition, but we talk about Jewish food a lot as like a negotiation between the food of that region and then being shaped by holidays and kosher rules. So, you know, for example, observant Jews don't cook on Shabbat. So in many different communities, there's overnight stews that so everyone has, many Jewish communities have an overnight stew because they're observing Shabbat. But the differences between them vary in the region. Like Iraqi Jews have something called tabit, which has rice and chicken that their overnight pot. A lot of Ashkenazi Jews have something called cholent, which has meat and oftentimes beans, you know, some vegetables. So all of these communities have the same idea, but it's different based on their region. But that's really being shaped by the holiday Shabbat, which we celebrate every week, and, you know, kosher laws. So something like a variation of a matzah ball is like, matzah ball is kind of the thing that is a uniquely Passover dish. So someone like Sasha Shore, who had the chanterelle mushroom, and, you know, that's like her family's tradition that she added into that. Or also in the Passover chapter, we have a Mexican matzo ball soup from this amazing chef, Fanny Gerson, who has La New Yorkina and Fan Fan Donuts. She grew up in Mexico City. So she has a kind of a classic Ashkenazi chicken matzo ball soup, but puts like cilantro, lime, avocado, jalapeno because that's the version that she grew up with in Mexico City. So I think there's always room for variation by, you know, where you grew up, what the terroir was, like how you're infusing, you know, multiple heritages into the food.
That's really awesome. So how did you find the people to contribute?
Good question. Well, we've been doing this work, you know, building our archive for over 5 years. So a little more. So many of the people featured in the book are people that we had spoken to for the archive, that we have relationships with, that we've collaborated with in the past. Sasha, the chanterelle matzo ball soup woman, we did like an amazing Hanukkah dinner with her. We've, you know, also in the Passover chapter, there's like an after Passover celebration called Mimuna, which is celebrated in the Moroccan Jewish communities. And we held our own Mimuna with that family. It's actually the family of Gabe Stolman, who's a restaurateur here in New York. Nice. So a combination of wanting to try to represent as much as we could in the book, but of course that's challenging and we've only just begun, and really leaders and people in our community that we felt had a great story to tell, and of course delicious recipes. So it was kind of a combination of all of those things together.
That's cool. Well, like I said at the beginning, the photography of the food in the cookbook is really beautiful, and like made me very hungry. And also just, it just seemed like so much to kind of put together and organize, especially from all these different sources.
That was a lot. Again, we have an incredible team that we worked with. We have our photographer for the book, Penny de los Santos, who's also someone that we've collaborated with many times. She really like brought this concept of the showing the tables like to life. It's so, you know, and so many creative people, food stylists, prop stylists, our team at Jewish Food Society, it really takes like a village to create something like that. And it's so funny to think about those days. I'm just really like picturing the photo shoots in my head and all the planning that we did and the lists and the shopping and like bringing everything together. And we also did some of that during the pandemic. So that was even like a challenge on another level. So I'll say this, we learned a lot. We're very proud, but we also learned a lot. So, just the last thing I'll say quickly is that we wanted the photos and obviously all of the recipes that we included in the book to show Jewish food like in the most vibrant, delicious, diverse way possible. And hopefully, you know, maybe bring a new way of looking at Jewish food to people. So it was extremely important for us to have the food, you know, and these tables look, you know, as really just as like vibrant as possible. And also the fun work that we get to do is kind of taking inspiration from the families and honoring them a lot. We interview the families extensively, like what would be on your table? What tablecloth would you want to use? Like, do you serve wine? Do you not? And like kind of gathering all of this information and then interpreting that in our own visual style. So being inspired and respectful of the family, but also how we reinvent, you know, how we get to bring that to life on the page.
That's really cool. Thanks for sharing that. And it's really interesting. You mentioned this, just that there are recipes from around the world. So not just, you know, what you would put on your holiday table, which I think is really cool. Are there any recipes that stick out to you that were like completely surprising or new or, you know, things that blew your mind that you hadn't thought of before?
Oh my gosh, so many. But now my table is full of global food. And, you know, I grew up in a family where food was definitely like important, but didn't grow up with so many of my own family recipes. I would call myself kind of like a classic New York Jewish family, culturally Jewish, but you know, I didn't have the kind of grandmother that spent like hours, you know, in the kitchen with these family recipes. So I feel lucky now that I get to choose and put whatever I want on my table, essentially, as long as it tastes good. One of the recipes, okay, so there's so many. There's this amazing salad in one of the chapters for Shavuot, which is like a springtime holiday that has cherries, cilantro, garlic, and jalapeno. And it sounds like a slightly strange. But when you make the salad, the flavors like coming together in this way, it's like a little bit sweet. It's a little spicy. It's herbaceous. Like you have, you're kind of hearkening to spring. Like that was one when I kind of saw the combination of all these things. I was like, I don't know about that. And then when I had it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Like I can't wait for cherries to come. That's one of my favorite recipes in the book. There's so many. It's like choosing a child. There's like an olive oil chocolate mousse from this amazing chef in the Passover chapter, Renat Sadok, that is like a lot of times if you're, you know, many families are eating, you know, observing kosher rules or eating kosher styles. So if you have like a meat meal as you would for Passover, like you wouldn't serve a dessert that would have dairy. So this is like a chocolate mousse, like without dairy, that is just so surprising and how like delicious it is.
I saw a picture of that when I was going through, and it looked amazing.
It's really good if you like chocolate. I don't know who doesn't, but.
Yeah, right. My last question, just in terms of the conversations you've had with all these families, how much of it is about the eating versus the cooking? Is, if that's even like possible to separate? Because I just wonder how much of this is the experience of preparing the food versus, you know, eating it, which is two separate phases, but like both are, you know, traditions that are passed down.
That's like extremely interesting and something really we could talk about for a long time, because I think the ultimate goal of like gathering and being around the table with your family is, you know, is just the sweet spot. That's so beautiful. But I think there's a few stories that we share in the book about actually the communal act of cooking together. And that I think this is something that happened more frequently longer, you know, in the past. There's another story in this Shavuot chapter from a Kurdish family who the tradition in their village was to, they would make this bread, stuffed bread for Shavuot holiday with like cheese and wild greens. And communally, the women in that community would cook together. This, like, they would have this like kind of makeshift big griddle that they would make, and everyone would come and make their, you know, item there. And there's a few other stories in the book from a Brazilian Jewish community that would cook, you know, together. So I think that's so beautiful, first of all. And I think that there's been many ebbs and flows in the idea of how we cook, cooking together. I think obviously a lot of the recipes that are older, one of the, you know, the main ingredient there is time. Hmm. You know, so you spend a lot more time cooking some of these ingredients, whether they're cured, whether it's overnight, you know. And then in the age of convenience and women starting to work or various factors, like sometimes a lot of cooking skewed to using more prepared or ready-made, you know, items. And now I think we're almost seeing the boomerang coming back to people taking pride in the ingredients, the freshness, the time that it does take to make, you know, some of these foods or to cook in general, Jewish or not. You know, I think that that's just a societal generational shift that we're seeing now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks for going into that. I know that you, the Jewish holiday table, came out last month, right? So you're and you can get it, I think, wherever you get books, right? But is there somewhere?
Yes.
Is there anywhere you want to send people specifically?
Sure, of course. Thank you so much. Okay, something tells me you've done this before and have. And I just, before we do that, I want to shout out, the book is written by Jewish Food Society's founder and executive director, Nama Sheffi, and our editor, Devra First. So I will give those women a shout out as they, you know, really are the leaders of this book, and the entire JFS team who helped bring it, you know, to life, of course, including myself. And in New York, one of my favorite bookstores is Kitchen Arts and Letters on the Upper East Side, and you can get signed copies there. And we just got back from Los Angeles doing a couple of events there. And my favorite, absolute favorite bookstore there is called Now Serving. I don't know if you know it.
No, I don't.
Super cool. They do amazing events and they have all culinary books.
Nice.
And there's signed copies waiting for anyone in the LA area there.
That's great. Well, thank you. And thank you for taking the time. And I know that you all are doing tons of work around this book and everything. So I appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Thank you so much for having me. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, we will talk again. I know that there's like you said, there's a lot of things that we could have gone into. But we will, and for those of you listening, thanks for listening. We're going to be back tomorrow with another conversation. But thank you all for tuning in. Thank you again, Amanda.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.